It seems as though there are a couple of different types of people who could best understand the book of Ecclesiastes. First would be those of you who are very, very bright or have raised children who are very, very bright. I don't mean to be funny when I say that. I think that Solomon, who was indeed the brightest of the bright, highly intelligent, in fact, a genius, illustrates the struggles of a person who is in that mental bracket. It's been my experience that the more brilliant a person, the greater, it seems, their number of struggles. The dullard, the sluggard, it seems, has few struggles in life, whereas those who are highly intelligent, who have found that the simple answers do not satisfy, they, in fact, have a ring of simplistic character. Those individuals struggle deeply, most deeply. As a result, individuals who are in this realm mentally come to a cynical side of life, often as it relates to spiritual things. That, I believe, is what happened to Solomon. But there's something more than that. The second group of people who would understand would be those of you who are going through or are living with individuals who are going through what I will call a midlife crisis. This is an interesting phenomenon of our era. It has always been true, but it seems to be growing more so, that individuals reach a plateau where they begin to question those things they have embraced all their lives. If you are struggling with the problem, and many, many are, you're certainly not alone, you need to read a book entitled Men in Midlife Crisis by Jim Conway. In the book, Mr. Conway has done a great deal to help us understand what that problem is about. I quote from several things he says. The man approaching midlife has some strange and difficult times ahead of him. The midlife crisis is a time of high risk for marriages. It is a time of possible career disruption and extramarital affairs. There is depression. There is anger. There is frustration and rebellion. The crisis is a pervasive thing that seems to affect not only the physical but also the social and cultural and spiritual and occupational expressions of a man's life. It's at the time when a man reaches the peak of a mountain range, he looks back over where he has come from and forward to what lies ahead, and he asks things like, now that I've climbed the mountain, why am I different for doing it? Do I feel fulfilled? Have I achieved what I wanted to achieve? He goes on to describe it in the form of a statistic. Lee Stockford presented findings based on 3 studies involving more than 2,100 men and women. His research indicated that 80% of the executives aged 34 to 42 were hit by the crisis. Dr. Daniel Levinson, a Yale researcher who has been involved in an extensive study of the midlife male, puts the midlife decade at about 35 to 45. Another, such as the book entitled Passages, echoes Levinson's view. Many, however, put this crisis at about the age of 50. 3 things happen to a person to make it generally a description of that at that time. First, some biological changes take place. He is losing physical vigor and muscle tone. His body weight is shifting. That's a nice way to put it, isn't it? He is losing his hair. That is a rather bold way to put it. Death suddenly becomes a reality. Second, psychological makeup changes. His ego, his self-image is drastically affected. He begins to view himself as less of a man because his view of self-worth stems from his physical strength. He may be having trouble or dissatisfaction at work, and because many men draw ego strength from their work, this may hurt his self-image. He may think he's not the man he used to be or planned to be. He may see that he's not going to meet all of his goals, or perhaps he has met them and is saying, so what? The third major area of life being affected is his social life. The world, in very clear tones, tells him there isn't meaningful life after 40, and he can't get a job after 45 or 50. Television commercials continue to affirm that youth is good and age is bad. He begins to reevaluate his life in social areas, his relationship to his wife, his children, his career, his colleagues, his friends, the world around him, and especially his God. It's been my observation that many men I've talked with who struggle with the problem have, for some reason or other, placed God out of their lives and have decided they are going to enjoy some things that they have been putting off all their days. And as far as they are concerned, God can wait for a while. They'll answer to him later on. And they're on their way in a sort of a quasi-psychological, social, spiritual tailspin until either crisis much greater than that one occurs, death itself, or some miraculous intervention, or simply the passing of time. I personally am of the opinion that Solomon was in the midlife crisis when he records the journal of the book of Ecclesiastes. I really believe that the man records for us his honest feelings when he reached that time where nothing seemed to satisfy. Before I go any further in the book, let's answer some questions that I think are essential to an appreciation and an understanding of the book. First of all, who wrote it? Verse 1 and verse 12 of chapter 1 will help us answer the question. These are the words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. There was only one son of David who became king in Jerusalem, and that was Solomon. And to raise any other question, verse 12 says, I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. Now, this same individual is named Solomon in other parts of the Bible. He is an adult. He has reached the pinnacle of success. He has reached the highest position in the land. He is to that nation what the president is to ours. His familiar habitat is the Oval Office. And suddenly, in that high-ranking position, cracks begin to appear in his thinking. We don't know why. We don't know what split. We don't know what occurred. We don't know why it occurred. We only know that it did. And the man began to question some of the foundational opinions that had been passed down from his father. And he had perhaps passed on to others. Solomon is the writer of the book. What's the meaning of the title? It's a long title that seems to have sort of a religious tone to it. What does Ecclesiastes mean? Well, it's an interesting word. It is the term that means master of assemblies. It's the thought of one who speaks as a speaker or a preacher to groups of people. He gathers thoughts and ideas and he shares them. Koheleth is the name used for preacher, and it's the word here with the idea of being a master of speakers or a master of assemblies. Hold your place here and answer the question with me as you look at 1 Kings 4. Was Solomon a public speaker? Would he qualify as that? 1 Kings 4. And I also want to read a parallel in 1 Kings 10. So find both chapters. We'll read chapter 4 first, and then we'll look at the reference in chapter 10. 4, verse 29. Now God gave Solomon wisdom and very great discernment and breadth of mind like the sand that is on the seashore. Now that doesn't simply mean he had a good theological understanding. It means he had a broad understanding of all of life. He could speak on many subjects, theology as well as others. Look down to verse 32. He spoke Proverbs, 3,000 of them. He wrote songs, over 1,000 of them. He spoke of trees from the cedar that is in Lebanon, even to the hyssop that grows on the wall. He was a botanist. He spoke also of animals and birds and creeping things and fish. His knowledge was broad. They came from all over to hear him speak as he gave lectures on this. Men came from all peoples to hear the wisdom of Solomon, from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. Was he popular? Chapter 10, verse 23. The King Solomon became greater than all the kings in the earth in riches and wisdom, and all the earth was seeking the presence of Solomon to hear his wisdom, which God had put in his heart. He not only had wisdom, he had money, he had fame, he had the world with a tail. He was eminently successful. But he went through the time of crisis that we read about in Ecclesiastes. In turning back to the book, let me say that many a person who is a public figure is nevertheless extremely human and struggles deeply. At times, cracks appear in the Oval Office of our own nation. It should never shock us that humanity is there. At times, dishonesty will emerge from the life of a senator, or immorality from the life of a congressman, or the life of a pastor, or the life of a counselor, or the life of a teacher or professor that you have admired much of your life. You have little reason to be disillusioned by that. It's the humanity in all of us. The only problem is that when it strikes a Christian, it becomes scandalous information. Solomon is honest enough to say, "I had struggles like you can't believe." And in the midst of those struggles, when things began to fracture and break in my mind, I kept a journal, and for some reason, God has preserved the journal of this master of assemblies. And I'll tell you what I went through as I searched for happiness without God. The third question is, what are the uniquenesses of the book itself? And there are a couple I want to add here. First of all, it is the most secular of all Bible books. If I were to speak to lost audiences and I were asked to use a Bible book, this is the book I would use. This is my preference. It hits people where they live in the secular world, and you'll see that as we work our way through. It's the most secular. About every major ism, even heresy, is found in this book. Look at chapter 2, verse 16, for example. "For there is no lasting remembrance of the wise man as with the fool, inasmuch as in the coming days all will be forgotten, and how the wise man and the fool alike die. So I hated life, for the work which had been done under the sun was grievous to me, because everything is futility and striving after wind." It's emptiness, it's futile, it's striving, it's of no use, it's of no value, there is no satisfaction. The words appear in their synonymous form 35 to 40 times in the book. It is a book that lacks satisfaction on the part of the writer. Look at the next page, chapter 3, verse 18, 19, and verse 20. "I said to myself concerning the sons of men, God has surely tested them in order for them to see that they are but beasts. For the fate of the sons of men and the fate of beasts is the same. As one dies, so dies the other. Indeed, they all have the same breath, and there's no advantage for man over beast, for all is vanity. All go to the same place. All came from the dust, and all return to the dust." Well, if that's not universalism, I've never read it. I mean, what good is it to be man as opposed to being a dog or a horse or or the cattle in the field? We're all the same. We come, we go, life has its monotonous repetition, and there is no meaning to it whatsoever. Now, this might shock some that have a very strong view of inspiration. I don't think anyone here could have one stronger than I. And I want to help you understand that inspiration does not guarantee that everything recorded is a rule to live by. Inspiration guarantees that what was written was accurately written and has been miraculously preserved. We have God breathing out his message through the pen of man. Not everything in this book is a rule to live by. The arguments in Ecclesiastes are not God's arguments. They are God's accurate record of man's argument. Remember that. Secular writers attack inspiration, and they take to task the book of Ecclesiastes and illustrate. You can believe that's inspired? Listen to what it says. I've seen it done in college classrooms, and I'm sure you will live to see it as well. This is simply guaranteeing we have an accurate record. It doesn't mean that everything is something to live by. The second thing I would say about Ecclesiastes is that it is one of the most convincing literary works declaring that apart from God, there's no satisfaction. If you're beginning to teeter on the tight wire in life, wondering if maybe it wouldn't be a lot better without God and all of that trip that God brings, as they say, get a good dose of Ecclesiastes and don't forget it. Because vicariously you can enter into all these pursuits with Solomon and you will wind up with the right answers without the scars. That's very, very important. How about the key verse? Is there a key verse to live by? You bet. Chapter 10, verse 19. I want you all to turn to it. There's your verse, men and women. Chapter 10, verse 19. I especially wanted the trustees of the church to see that verse. Men prepare a meal for enjoyment, wine makes life merry, and money is the answer to everything. I'm just kidding you. That's not the key verse. It's over in chapter 2, verse 11. Chapter 2, verse 11. That verse will set you free, so get away from that one. Get over to chapter 2, verse 11. I had some men walking out saying, yes, that's the verse. I'm leaving. I'm going right now. No. The only reason to walk out is to see the game. And if I stay, you stay, baby. Don't you get out of here. Chapter 2, verse 11. Thus I considered all my activities which my hands had done and the labor which I had exerted. And behold, everything was vanity and striving after wind. There is no profit under the sun, as he beats his breast. I cannot find any satisfaction in life. The reason is, he has X'd out God. He has everything a man or woman could want. He has simply put his God on the shelf. And he has told his father, as it were, forget it, David. He has told his heritage, forget it. He has told his nation, forget it. I don't need Jehovah. I am going to find happiness without God. And he says in chapter 2, verse 11, you know, I didn't get what I needed. What I wound up with was a mouthful of cotton candy, a handful of air, a lot of froth. Hard as it may be for you to believe this, some of you who are young, some of the most struggling, most disillusioned men and women today are those who hold chairs in the highest places of universities around our country and around our world. As one of them said in a very incredible speech that I read recently, the real question now that faces us in life is whether or not we commit suicide. They have no answers. Solomon is there. And rather than committing suicide, he simply says, I am going to find that happiness. I'm up to here with Jehovah. I'm up to here with the disciplines of the Christian life. I have had it. I have seen my last day in the temple. I am on my way to real living. And he takes off. And he tells you about it in the book of Ecclesiastes. Go back to chapter 1. Let's get a survey right quick. The question behind everything he writes is life really worth living? Is it really worth living? He begins with the monotony of life. And I want to show you several of these monotonous cycles. It's boring as he sees it. Verse 3, what advantage does man have in all his work which he does under the sun? Ever ask yourself that question? As you drive on that crummy freeway all the way to Torrance, all the way down to L.A., every day, don't you ask, What advantage is there? All I'm going to do is get there, spend 8 hours, turn around, and go all the way back to Fullerton. Day after day, year after year, what advantage is it? You look at me like you don't believe that. That's exactly what goes through our minds. What in the world are all of these miles going to prove when it's all over? Only that next week I've got to drive them again. There is an incredible boredom connected with life. I don't think that's addressed enough in the pulpit. I don't think other Christians are saying much about that. But many of you who hear my voice at this moment are desperately bored with life. Here's another one, verse 4. A generation goes, a generation comes, the earth remains forever. The sun rises, the sun sets, hastens to its place, and there it rises again. The wind blows to the south, it blows to the north, it continues swirling along. The circular course, the wind returns. The rivers flow into the sea, yet the sea is never full. To the place where the rivers flow, they flow again. All things are wearisome. Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing. And the ear is not satisfied with hearing. Have you noticed that? Are you into sound equipment? You'll learn that. Used to be that you would be satisfied with a simple little record player. Just a little record, put it on, put the needle on, zip, you'd hear it, fantastic. You go to sleep, humming the tune. Not now. Now you've got all of these incredible kinds of equipment that you can get into, right? I know, my son has begun to get into it, and I'll tell you, it is unbelievable. You thought you were satisfied until you run across Panasonic Zip Zap red blue deal that they show you, and you say, wow, that looks great. Mine sounds like it's from Hunger. I've got to get one like that. So you get one like that. You bring it home and you enjoy it. It's beautiful. And the guy says to you, don't you realize that you got to have sound equipment that's made by a certain firm for you to really enjoy that? So you know, I didn't know that. So you go get that system and you begin to listen to it. And he says, don't you realize that those speakers will never handle the sound that's going to come out of that equipment? No, I didn't know that. So you go out, you get speakers the size of this baptistry, you know, great big things, and they blow you away. And then a guy says, do you hear that click in that speaker? And you think, oh man, I never realized that click was in. I can't live with that. So you go buy another set of speakers. It never ends. It never stops. It's constant. You thought you liked your home until you saw the one four blocks away. Good night, man, that's fantastic. I can't live in this dump. We got to get into that one. And so you move into that one, and the tile breaks, and you got to replace the tile, and you got to fix the kitchen up. And before you know, somebody says, do you know, this house is worth so much more. Get a new one. You know, 30 miles away, you can get one and make on. Okay, man, so you sell your home, and you move out there, and it's constant, constant, constant. It never ends. And Solomon is just putting into plain old English the kind of stuff that we think, and we think we're the only ones thinking it. Is there an end to all of this? I mean, is it possible to be satisfied? Not without God. See, he is the dimension that brings it into balance. He is the one who says you can be contented. Like the woman who wrote, the good life exists only when you stop wanting a better one. It is the condition of savoring what is rather than the longing for what might be. The itch for things, so brilliantly injected by those who make and sell them, is in effect a virus draining the soul of contentment. A man never earns enough. A woman is never beautiful enough. Clothes are never new enough. The house is never furnished enough. The food is never fancy enough. There is a point at which salvation lies in stepping off the escalator and saying, enough. What I have will do. What I make of it is up to me. Solomon's on the escalator. And it's running fast. He can't get a handle on it. There is hopelessness. There is despair. There is emptiness. Purposelessness. And so he begins to pursue the things that he thinks will satisfy. He begins a hedonistic pursuit in chapter 2. Turn there. He begins the pursuit that says, pleasure at all cost. Verse 1, I said to myself, come now, I will test you with pleasure. So enjoy yourself. The same old playboy philosophy. Behold, it was futility. I said of laughter, it's madness. And of pleasure, what does it accomplish? You know, a laugh a day doesn't work. How about a bottle a day? So chapter 2, verse 3, he turns to booze. I explored with my mind how to stimulate my body with wine, while my mind was guiding me wisely in how to take hold of folly, until I could see what was good, what good there is for the sons of men to do under heaven the few years of their lives. That didn't work. And so since laughter wasn't working and drink wasn't working, let's do things with my hands. So I engaged in construction. Verse 4, I built houses. I planted vineyards. I made gardens and parks for myself. I planted all kinds of fruit trees. I could have told him that wouldn't work. I made ponds of water for myself from which to irrigate a forest of growing trees. I brought male and female slaves, and I had home-born slaves. I possessed flocks and herds. I got into livestock. Does that sound like today's man? Oh, the Bible is so relevant. I possessed flocks and herds larger and larger than all preceded me in Jerusalem. He even got into that scene. I collected for myself silver and gold. He had coin collections and precious gems. And the treasure of kings and provinces. I provided for myself male and female singers and the pleasures of men. There were gestures. There were choirs that came and entertained me, and I sat back and drank it in, and it didn't satisfy. I had many concubines. I went the sex trip. I went that whole scene. I took the whole nine yards, and that wasn't where it was. And I considered all my activities, verse 11, after all the things my eyes desired, I didn't refuse them, verse 10. I took all my activities which my hands had done, and behold, all of it was a bag of wind. If you're a searcher and if you think pleasures will do it and bucks will do it and things will do it and stuff that you can build and perfect will do it, stop. You won't do it. You can never go the limit Solomon went. He went further than any of us will ever go, and he says, it won't do it. Abraham to the Middle East Crisis is a fine book by a fellow named G. Frederick Owen. In it, he describes Solomon in brief terms, but very, very vividly. I'll share them with you. Maddened with the love of show, Solomon swung into a feverish career of wastefulness, impropriety, and oppression. Not satisfied with the necessary buildings and legitimate progress of his past years, he overburdened his people with taxation, enslaved some, and ruthlessly instigated the murder of others. All Solomon's drinking vessels were of gold, and those of his house of pure gold. The shields of his mighty men were made of beaten gold, and his great throne was made of ivory and overlaid with the finest gold. Silver in Jerusalem became as common as stones. Solomon literally built himself a paradise of pleasure. One of his chief resorts was Etham, where when the mornings were beautiful, listen to this, he often went in stately progress, dressed in snow-white raiment, riding in his chariot of state, which was made of the finest cedar, decked with gold and silver and purple, and carpeted with the costliest tapestry, worked by the daughters of Jerusalem. He was attended by a bodyguard of 60 valiant men of the tallest and handsomest of the young Israelis, arrayed in Tyrian purple, with their long black hair freshly sprinkled with gold dust every day, glittering in the sun. Solomon, like many another absolute monarch, drove too fast and traveled too far. He became debauched and effeminate, an egotist, a cynic, so satiated with the sensual and material affairs of life that he became skeptical of everything good. To him, all became vanity and futility. Look at verse 20. I completely despaired. Look at those words. I completely despaired of all the fruit of my labor, for which I had labored under the sun. That's a man in midlife crisis, if you've ever read him. It's almost a sense of self-pity. I've worked and worked and worked. I've labored hard. I've worked my fingers to the bone to put together all of life. And what do I have to show for it? Some cynic answers, bony fingers. That's all you've got. And he looks at his hands that are empty. He looks at his life that's empty. He looks at his soul that's filled with guilt. And he says, verse 24, there's nothing better for a man to do than eat, drink, and tell himself his labor is good. Just keep pressing on. And that's what 95% of the people you run into are saying. Just keep going. Just keep going. Don't stop and ask. Just keep going. God says, put on the brakes. You keep going, you'll dangle from a rope. Stop. Preferably stop while you're young. Solomon turns to fatalism in chapter 3. There's a time for this, there's a time for that. Then there's a humanism that comes into the scene. I know, verse 12, that there's nothing better for them than to rejoice and do good in one's lifetime. Verse 15, that which has been already and that which will be has already been, for God seeks what has passed by. I have seen under the sun that in the place of justice there's wickedness, in the place of righteousness there is wickedness, and I'm confused. Verse 20, we all go to the same place, why sweat it? That's cynicism to the maximum. There's a smattering of agnosticism as well as universalism all the way through. Hold your place here and look at Proverbs 14:12. There is a way which seems right to a man, but its end is the way of death. You've heard the verse and maybe didn't quite know where to put your finger on it. There it is. There is a way that seems right, but it doesn't satisfy. Listen to the commercials. View the films, read the media, check it out regularly. You will hear it pulsating. There's always something new, something different, something brighter, something larger, something softer, something with a better aroma, something more, more, more. Solomon says, without God, nothing will do it. Nothing. So chapter 4, he begins to observe. He's not involved now. He's just observing. Maybe he's getting tired. He observes oppression, chapter 4, verses 1 to 3. He sees poverty. He sees pain. He sees abuse. He sees crime. He sees the social life. And he says, it's better not to be born. In verses 4 through 6, he looks at industry and idleness, and he says the industrious is envied by his neighbor, and the idle doesn't get the job done, and it caves in on him. You can't win one way or the other. He looks at solitude and loneliness in verses 7 and 8. He looks at companionship in verses 9 through 12, and that doesn't fit. And he looks 13 through 16 at popularity, and that doesn't fit. He says in the last part of verse 16, it's all vanity and striving after wind. Chapter 5, the same. Chapter 6, chapter 7, chapter 8, 9, 10, until chapter 11. Chapter 11, there is a switch. The whole smorgasbord is sort of passed in review. And now he begins to pass along a little advice. He's come to a pause in his pursuits, and he says it's time to write a chapter. And maybe someone someday will read it. In verses 1 through 6, he talks about the investment of your life in verses 7 through 8, the enjoyment of life, and 9 and 10, the end of life. You want a good devotional to bring to a secular group? Have at it. There it is, right in front of you. Is life worth spending? That's, if it's worth spending, it's worth spending on someone other than myself. I've learned that, says Solomon. Cast your bread on the waters, for you'll find it after many days. There's a risk involved. There's a risk in dividing your portion to 7 or even 8. You don't know what may occur, but let it go. Release it. Have you accrued something? Let it out. Let it go. Has God blessed you with material goods? Share those material goods. Don't die with a big sack full of them. What good will it do in a box? Don't leave it for the state. They'll rip it off. Give it to your kids. Give it to the ministry of good things. Watch eternal things bloom and blossom. Cast your bread out there on the waters. Enjoy what life is about. Look at verse 9. I can see Solomon like a professor leaning across a desk, and he says, young man, listen to me right now. Got it? He says, rejoice, young man, in your youth, and let your heart make you happy in the days of your youth, and walk in the ways of your own desire, and let your eyes be satisfied and your heart be pleased. But for all of this, God will bring you into account. Ever had your daddy tell you that? Maybe never. That daddy is telling you that tonight. That daddy cares enough for you as his child to tell you the truth before you get scarred. You think it's fun and games to mess around, have at it, relax, blow it, let it all out? Let me tell you, says Solomon, whose body was probably racked by venereal disease, whose mind was beginning to crack, whose whole structure for living was being altered and shifted and changed. Let me tell you, says Solomon, God brings you into judgment and you haven't been dealt with like he can deal with you. Remove vexation from your heart. Put pain away from your body. Childhood and the prime of life are fleeting. When you get old, you start talking like that. Oh, remember how things used to be. Or, oh, if I had it to do over again. And all of that. What are we doing? We're reflecting back on the prime of life. And as I look out into your faces, I see most of you in the prime of life. I think, what a relevant message. A hitch in the Marine Corps did more for me than any 20 years in a seminary would ever do regarding life. I saw it in the raw, I mean filthy raw of life. By the grace of God, I've experienced a protective shield from the blast of the flesh, but it was tough. But as a result of that perspective God gave me, I was able to minister only for a few months, 18 months, on an island overseas. But I tell you, I saw men picked up from the gutter. One young man stumbled in on a New Year's night, and I happened to be there writing a letter to my wife. I was the only one, I think, in the world at the base on New Year's night. And I heard the door open, and I heard him crying. 19-year-old young man from Idaho. He shuffled down and ran into several lockers on the way down, and he fell over in his vomit right behind me, right where I was sitting. I turned around and I called him by name, and he said, I need help. And he began to describe where he had been and what he had done, and he was convinced that he was diseased. His mouth, his person, he was the living end of life in its degradation. And I picked him up and I put my arms around him and I said, you've come to the place where God wanted you to be years ago. Let's deal with it right now. I cleaned him up, showered him, got him sober. At 2 o'clock in the morning, outside under the moon, this guy gave his life to Jesus Christ. He said, I've never known what it meant to be really clean. As he began to pour out his life. And he said, I just wish that I could erase about 5 bad years. He did have a disease. It did take its toll on him. As far as I know, he's doing okay now. But here he was, not even 20 years old. Never had a father tell him what you just heard. Remember your Creator in the days of your youth. That's smart. That's smart. Fit your Creator into your plan of life. Fit your Creator into your intellectual life. Don't limit it. Let it run free. Let it run fast and let it go and experience the fulfillment of all that your mind will let you. But keep him in focus. You don't have to cut off your head and commit intellectual suicide because you're a Christian. Some of the sharpest people you'll ever want to meet are believers on the cutting edge of the intellectual world. It's a beautiful blend to watch. And he says, remember him early in life. That's smart. Before the scars come and dull the edge. And you have to look back and say, when the years are over, I have no delight in them. Ugh. Do that before old age comes. One of the most interesting, and there's even a little humor in this description of old age, interesting list of old age characteristics is right here in chapter 12. Look at them with me for a moment. Life really does creep up on you. I told you before, about the time your face clears up, your mind gets fuzzy. And here's old Solomon describing it right now. Remember your Creator before the sun, the light, the moon, the stars are darkened, before the clouds return after the rain. In the day when the watchmen of the house tremble, there's a picture of the hands beginning to tremble. And the mighty men stoop, that's the legs, they get weary, they get weak. The grinding ones stand idle. Can you guess what that is? Right, they get less and less in your jaws. And those who look through windows grow dim. That's your eyes. You can't see like you used to see. Man, I realize that. My lenses are so thick when I look at the sun, my pupils smoke. I went to my ophthalmologist. I said, that's it. I look like a snake behind this glass. He says, they're not going to get any thinner. I can't wear contacts. I can't blink over the edges. They'd be that thick. It's incredible. And I got to have bright lights now. I used to be able to read with a flashlight in a tent. Remember? You leave them around in there. Not now. I got to have 1,000 watts on top to see the words. And the doors on the street are shut, and the sound of the grinding mill is low. That's your ears. You get hard of hearing. And one will arise at the sound of the bird, and all the daughters of song will sing softly. That's insomnia. You wake up early. You get old. You older. You wake up earlier and earlier. And boy, I used to think, man, I'm not going to do that. I'm going to sleep late like the young folks do, and I'm getting up at 5:00. I feel like a dummy. I'm out on the patio listening to the birds sing, wondering why I can't sleep. Everybody else is sleeping. I want to say, wake up, guys. If I wake up, everybody else wakes up. Men are afraid of high places and the terror on the road. That happens when you get old. You take a trip with an old person, and you'll never realize how many calamities were upon. No, don't go into the tomb close to the edge. Watch it. Don't get near that. You'll fall over. Break your neck. Now, I remember the comedian who says, for all my life, I thought the only injury I could have as a child was a broken neck. My mother would say, don't go there, you break your neck. Don't fall, break your neck. We took a trip with my mother, God bless her, when she was getting up in years, and we went to Colorado, and we went up that deal, you know. She rode the whole trip looking like this. I'm not looking over the edge. Oh, don't go so close to the edge the entire time. She never enjoyed it because you're so close to the edge, you're going to fall over the edge. That happens when you get old. When you're young, man, you want to hang glide. Yeah, that's fine. Just jump on out there. When you get older, no. You don't even want to look at it in the movies. Remember him, verse 6, before the silver cord is broken, then paralysis sets in. This is the old spinal cord. And the golden bowl is crushed. And the pitcher by the well is shattered. There's a coronary. And the wheel of the cistern is crushed. The old respiratory system grinds to a halt. Remember him before death comes. Hey, that is such good counsel. Don't wait till it comes, see. You don't have to keep it up. You don't have to keep going, keep going, keep doing all that stuff. Like the one lady who wrote her testimony, she wrote an anxiety poem called Self-Improvement Program. Let me say it again. Self-Improvement Program. When after a recitation of many new advances in everything from needlepoint to guitar to advanced Chinese cooking to primal scream therapy, she concludes this in her poem. I'm working all day and I'm working all night to be good looking, healthy and wise and adored and contented and brave and well-read and a marvelous hostess and bilingual, athletic, artistic. Won't someone please stop me? Honest woman. That's what Ecclesiastes is trying to do. Stop. Now just stop. And do what? Well, verse 13, the conclusion. Number one, fear God. That means take him seriously. Number two, obey God. Do what he says. This applies to every person. We have trafficked in perhaps some of the wisest of counsel we could ever hear. Some of us wish we could have heard it 40 years ago. Some of us wish we had heard it directly and correctly when we did hear it. Let me tell you who concerns me the most. That's the kid that's raised in the church, born in a choir loft, never known a Sunday when he wasn't in the joint. Church every Sunday, week after week, month after month, Sunday school, all those badges. Didn't you used to resent kids that had those badges that hang on? They'd lean over and go, whoo, I used to want to go all over there. They're the ones that concern me the most because they never know a Sunday when they weren't around. They've heard it all. They've seen it all. I mean, their lips move when you talk about the doctrines. They got it down. Graduated from eighth grade deal. Graduated from high school. Summa cum, whatever, laude how come, you know, they got out, got into college, Christian stuff, Christian school, Christian teaching, Christian parents, Christian truth, Christian churches, and then all of a sudden, boom, the lid goes off. And they wonder why. Somebody, somewhere down the line didn't stop and say, hey, what you're picking up is a whole bunch of cliches about religion. Christ isn't vital in your decision as to what car to drive or what career to choose or what decision to make when you're on that date. Christ isn't real. You're just caught up in a syndrome and you've added a lot of extra vernacular that you've picked up all your life. But now that the bills come due and you're surrounded by the sidewalk jungle of competition, you can't cut it. And you're on that plane headed to nowhere, and you suddenly realize, I am not prepared for life. Midlife crisis, here I come. I want to tell you, if it could happen to Solomon, it can happen to anybody who hears my voice. Anybody. If it helps you any, I fight like mad that it doesn't happen to me. I address it regularly in my mind. I don't need that stuff. It has no satisfaction. It is an enemy to God. What I need is Him in all of His beauty and perfection and care and loveliness. And I need to live under the cross. If I didn't believe that, I'd be a wild stallion. And if He can slow me down, He can slow you down too. Let's bow together, shall we? For some of you, this message is perhaps the most relevant thing you could have ever heard this year. For others of you, thank God you've come through it. And you see the fallacy of it, and you've just simply had it confirmed. But for some, it still isn't convincing enough. Not convincing enough to break off that affair. Or to say to yourself, I'm going to be satisfied with enough. No, it's for some not that easily learned. Whatever it takes to come to terms with this in your life, I, as your friend and as your shepherd, urge you to do it. The years you have left are a gift from God. You spend them like a coin, any way you wish, but only once. Father, I pray for the man or the woman who spent their years paying for braces, buying bikes, giving up what they wanted, raising kids, planning and going through the vacations, continually giving, continually releasing, who are on the very real cutting edge of a crisis. For them, I pray, as the hurricane velocity hits them in this world system, I pray for you to give them roots that will not give, will not break, and will not bend. I ask you to raise up from among the young of this church a body of men and women who are balanced, in no way shocked by the world system, but very much in touch with it, knowing fully what it means and what it's like, but by your grace, inexperienced in it, and therefore, for the most part, unscarred. And I pray that you will send, like missiles of your grace, some of these people into lives that haven't the foggiest of what has been declared tonight. I pray that you would put us in touch with and keep us in touch with those that do not know the answers, so that we might learn what questions to ask. We ask not so much for knowledge, but we ask for wisdom. Not so much for being sharp and keen, but for being discerning. And I would pray that you would use this message to help that to be accomplished. Help us in the process not to leave our warm love for Christ, who is our all in all. In the name of Jesus Christ, our Lord. Amen.
The preceding message, Ecclesiastes, Searching for the Meaning of Life, was copyrighted in 1979, and the sound recording was copyrighted in 2011 by Charles R. Swindoll, Inc. All rights are reserved worldwide.